Hi, I'm Scott Miller, host of Career on Course, where our vision is in the coming months and years to interview hundreds, if not thousands, of career experts to bring to you all the details you need to make better career decisions for you. We will have piercingly insightful conversations with an occupational therapist, a software developer, a wind turbine technician, pastry chef, event planner, chief financial officer, a barber, you name it. If the career exists, I'm going to interview them and bring to you what's the day in the life look like? What are the ups and the downs? What are the interpersonal conflicts? How do you pivot out? How do you stay in? When people burn out, why do they leave? Every question you might have, I'm intending to ask a wide variety of career professionals so that this podcast can help you pick better. Let's get started with getting your career on course. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Career on Course. I'm your host, Scott Miller, where each episode we interview a different career expert with the mission of helping you pick better. This Career on Course podcast has a series of weekly episodes that help you better understand what is it really like to be a commercial airline pilot, to be an orthopedic surgeon, to be a neurologist, to be a barber, to be a wind turbine technician. This podcast is focused on helping you understand the ins and the outs, the ups and the downs, and all of the preparation necessary to have a great career. I've been passionate about this concept for a decade plus. My most recent book was titled also Career on Course, just released, is now a number one new release on Amazon. The tagline is 10 strategies to help you take your career from accidental to intentional. In many ways, this is the 11th strategy, interviewing what will be hundreds, if not thousands, of professionals to help you better understand, is this the right career journey for you? Today, our spotlight is on a hotel general manager. We have David Araya, who's just joined us from a cross international flight. He just flew in from Madrid, Spain to Dallas, Texas. So it's about 7 hours in the morning, his time. We're taping this late in the evening. David Araya, welcome to Career on Course.
Thank you, Scott. I hope I can stay awake for you here.
I hope you had a refreshing shower and a little bit of caffeine to have a great conversation. Although I know you have, like me, a bit of an indefatigable level of energy. And so I'd love to dive into what your career has been like as a hotel general manager. We'll get into some of those more specifics in a moment. But David, I'd like you to take a few minutes and orient yourself to the audience, where you were born, where you went to school, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit about your career journey, all the steps that led you to become one of now what is the world's most renowned hotel general managers, and all that's done for you and unfolded for you in your career of hospitality.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to showcase this beautiful career that I've created. I was born in La Paz, Bolivia, and I'm the fifth of six boys. And so my home was pretty chaotic, to say the least. In fact, funny enough, we called it Hotel Araya because there was always people coming and going through my home. And I was always this kid that was just trying to make people happy. So when my brother's friends would come to the house or we'd have people over, I was the one that was offering them a beverage. I was the one that was offering them a plate of cut fruit. And that was just my personality and my style since I was very young. So that then transformed into a career in something that at the time I had no idea what to describe, but ended up being the beautiful language of hospitality.
Let's talk about that a bit further, because somehow you made it from La Paz up to, I think it was South Carolina, where you went to college. Talk a little bit about your entry, if you will, into your undergraduate degree, and then walk us through what really has been, as I count them, maybe close to 8 or 10 different really extraordinary appointments across some of the best brands in the world, and what most recently has been your role.
Yeah, so we'll take one step back before I actually get to college, because right out of high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do yet. And my parents couldn't afford to send me to college in the US after having four brothers that had done so. And we needed to find an alternative. And my parents and I decided to have me go on a cultural exchange program. And I landed in the south of France. And I had three criteria for this exchange program. The first one was to be around people. The second was to be around the ocean, because I came from Bolivia, landlocked country. And the third one was to speak another language. And that's what I wrote down in the application form. And I landed in a resort. And so my first role ever outside of high school was to be a bartender in this resort. But over the course of a year and a half, I basically had every job you could imagine at that resort. So I painted during the off season. I cleaned beds. I cooked in the kitchen. I was a bartender. So I did a little bit of everything and got a taste of hospitality, and I fell in love, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So then you fast forward, I get back to Bolivia after the exchange program, and my mind was set on getting to the US and on starting my career in hospitality. And so I got a soccer scholarship and went to Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And I got my degree in international business and hospitality management. So I got a dual degree. And on my last year of college, I actually became the manager of the hotel that the school had for parents and for students, and everybody in the university kind of knew me as the hotel kid because I was so excited about what my career would be and I was very vocal about it. And so fittingly, I became the hotel manager for the school. And that was a very important piece of my career progression because my first job out of college was actually a leadership role already. And I decided to move to New York City right outside of college and start my career. I landed at the Pier in New York City on 61st and 3rd as the assistant front office manager, wearing a double-breasted suit and thick tie and just on top of the world here in the Big Apple. And I had a really great, amazing start. We opened that hotel as a Taj Hotel. So it had previously been a Four Seasons, but then I opened it as a Taj Hotel. And then my career continued. And so from that point, my wife, now wife and mother of my children, then my fiance, Jessica, and I decided to start a family. And we figured that New York probably was not the most conducive place to starting a family. So we made the move of looking outward. And that's when Miami came about and Fountain Blue. So I joined a 1500 room hotel, basically the opposite of what the Pier is in New York City, the old Grand. 1500 rooms, 10 pools, 10 restaurants, one of the most impressive and successful nightclubs in the world called Live. So a completely different environment. And I started there as a front office manager. I call that my trampoline hotel because I had four different roles in a matter of 5 years, and it really propelled my career. I started as a front office manager, then became the assistant director of front office, then took over the front office operation, and then I had this really unique role that we created where I was the hotel manager representing the entire executive committee from a guest perspective, but also leaning into Six Sigma and quality control and really starting to bridge gaps between the different areas around the hotel that are typical gaps that happen. From Fountain Blue, then serendipitously, I met the CEO of a company from Hong Kong called Swire Hotels, part of a much bigger conglomerate called Swire Properties. He offered me the opportunity to go and spend 2 years in Hong Kong in what they called a brand dunk, so a brand immersion, where they took me and posted me in one of the hotels as the hotel manager. But I had the opportunity to test all the other properties, to open a hotel with them and do so many different things throughout the brand, to then bring that brand to the United States for the first time. So I was the first employee for the brand in the United States and was responsible for the pre-opening and opening design development of this hotel in Miami in Brickell in the city center. And the hotel was attached to a much larger mixed-use development. Incredible experience, and I was so grateful for that. I actually started as the hotel manager, and then before departing, I had been named the acting general manager, but I decided to make a move because one of these brands that I'd always looked up to, Four Seasons, came knocking on my door and offering me a role. And it was just, I couldn't pass that up. And so rather than sticking to being a GM, which was my ambition at the age of 30, and I just made it, I just turned 31 when I'd officially gotten the title of acting GM, I decided to take a step back and go back into a number two role as director of operations or resort manager. So I did that in Lanai, Larry Ellison's private island in Hawaii, 3,000 people on the island. So we employed one third, and then the other third, one third was too old and one third was too young. So we basically employed everyone on the island. And that was another incredible experience. It was a very unique resort because it had the beach operation, but it also had private boats, and it had an archery facility, and it had skeet shooting, and it had two golf courses. It was an incredible, expansive resort and a wonderful experience. And then I, for personal reasons, decided to move my family and I to Austin, Texas. So in conversations with Four Seasons, we decided to have a second experience as a hotel manager, this time in a city hotel environment with a different type of ownership group. It was basically a REIT that managed this hotel, or owned the hotel, and we operated it for them. But a very different way of approaching the Four Seasons experience. And I was the hotel manager there before COVID hit. And then, like with the majority of the people in the hospitality industry, things got shaken up. My position became irrelevant within the hotel, and I was on the wrap to becoming a GM for them. But the project that was slated for me got delayed, and so I needed to pivot. that's when I joined Auberge. Auberge, in many ways, is a young version of Four Seasons, is what Four Seasons used to be like when they were starting off. So at the time, there was about 14, 15 hotels. Now they're at about 24, I think, since I joined and left. But I had the opportunity to go and help out during the middle of COVID in Aspen, Colorado, at Hotel Jerome, where, again, I started as a number two, but then jumped into the number one role as GM when the person that was leading the charge decided to leave. And I did that for a season and a half before I then moved to Mexico to open their third hotel for the brand in Mexico, but the first in the Mexican Caribbean. And I opened that beautiful project called Ethereo and built a team from scratch and really created a very unique culture and offering in that hotel. And then I got a call from the ownership group at Six Senses, which is now a phenomenal property. It's considered one of the world's 50 best. And that was a real treat to be able to work in that resort, to be able to go to Europe, back to Europe for me and to Europe for my family, which was a big dream of ours. And then after that, I joined a group out of Mexico called Nomade People that were in a very interesting point in their life. They were starting to expand the brand and they were in need of an operational partner to the new CEO. And so I joined as the COO, taking me out of the daily operation in the hotel, and another magnificent experience. So as you can see, Scott, I've been all over the world, from Hawaii to Hong Kong, multiple stints, different brands, and it's been an incredible journey so far.
Okay, if there is a single listener that is questioning whether or not I have the right person for this interview, then we've got a problem. I'm going to recap this for a moment, because this is like the star-studded hospitality career, because I'm going to ask you lots of questions around how you pivoted, how you got to where you are, the role that you're in. But you started at the college functioning hotel, right? Or working almost like a teaching hospital, right? But when you launched up to the Pierre, one of the most iconic hotels in New York City, you then head down to the Fontainebleau Miami, which has just been had a huge rebrand and is now the most famous hotels in America. You then head over to Hong Kong for a couple of years with the Swire, back down to Miami, over to the Four Seasons in Lanai, then the Four Seasons in Austin. Then you upgrade, as if there was an upgrade from the Four Seasons, to the Auberge, what is the known as the Hotel Jerome in Aspen, probably the best well-known boutique hotel of any ski resort in America. Then you head down to, with the same brand, Auberge, to Etero, Mexico, Six Senses in Ibiza, Nomadic People in Mexico, and now you're consulting, you're authoring, you're writing, you're advising, lots of things. Remarkable career. David, I want to rewind a couple of decades. You talked a little bit about cutting fruit for your family and serving Hotel Araya. Was there like a certain decision-making process where you said, I want to be in hospitality. What I want to do is I want to lead hotels. Was there a mentor, a coach, an experience, something that happened that said, this is my route? Or did it evolve over time?
It was pretty clear for me. So there's two moments. The first one was when I was in high school, I thought I wanted to be a computer scientist. That's what I was. I was sure that's what I was going to be doing. And I'll tell you why, because I was downloading illegal music and I was chatting with girlfriends on Messenger all day long. So I was in front of my computer all day, but that had nothing to do with what a computer scientist does. And I remember my grandmother telling me very clearly, if you are in front of a computer all day long, you will wither away, David. You are not the person that needs to be in front of a computer. And I remember, and I mentioned this because my grandmother was the one that gave me access to beautiful hotels when I was a child. And I remember now when I would walk into a lobby and the smell and the sights and the sounds, and my brothers and they would always flock to wherever the food was, right? Wherever the candy was, wherever the food was. And I would just sit there mesmerized in the lobby and I would just look at all the small details. And I remember that feeling. And I still get that same exact feeling when I walk into a hotel. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece was definitely this career, this cultural exchange program, because I actually landed in a job as a bartender taking care of people. And in the first 30 minutes of taking that job, I knew that I wanted that job. And I knew that it was the right thing for me to take care of people through food and beverage, through making people feel good. I was always, again, my home was the fun home because we always had tons of people around. And so it was always easy for my friends to come to my house. And I didn't realize this at the time, but I needed to make sure that we had enough food. I needed to make sure we had enough drinks. I needed to make sure that the radio was working and that the music was right and that I downloaded the right songs for the party. And I did all of that naturally. And it was a natural progression into just people being in spaces, taking care of people, which was the natural progression for me. So by the time I walked into the first day of university, I knew that I wanted a career in hospitality. And in fact, the day that I met Jessica and I sold her the dream that we would travel the world and we would work in hotels for the rest of our life. And she bought it.
I think in some ways you answered my next question, which was, are there natural personality traits and interests that lead someone to become a hotel general manager? And I think you answered it. It really is a desire to serve.
It is. It's a desire to make people happy. And it comes with good and bad, right? Because you're a people pleaser by heart and by natural tendency. And so sometimes it works in your favor very much in the hospitality industry, but it comes with some disappointment as well, I would say. And the other piece that is critical and is the leadership component. Another element that I didn't mention yet of my upbringing was the fact that I played soccer at a pretty high level. And so I was always part of teams and I was always the captain on these teams. And so my natural tendency was always to be the glue to bring people together. When somebody needed a bit of a shout, then I would give them the shout. When somebody needed to be pulled back, I pulled them back. And so I wasn't always the most talented person on the teams that I played in, but I definitely was the leader on the field with my teams. And so that is the other element, because you're working for people, with people, through people, right? So it's all about people management.
Okay, thank you for indulging me on the lead up, because I wanted people to understand you don't just vault into becoming a hotel general manager out of school. You had, I documented, were 10 jobs. I'm guessing there were more than those. There were 10 careers, but I'm guessing there were more like 15 jobs along the way. Our spotlight today is a career titled Hotel General Manager, but I know that all hotels aren't created equal. That doesn't mean that there aren't different segments and different desires for people's budgets. We travel differently on business than we do on vacation. Maybe you would take a minute at the most and just orient everybody to what are the natural segmentations of hotels and where do the brands that you've been magnetized to fit in that, if you will, kind of segmentation?
Sure. So just the broad distinction between the types of hotels is that you've got limited service hotels and full service hotels. So for the purpose of this conversation, we'll stick to the full service hotels. Limited service hotels typically mean that they don't have any food and beverage, for example, right? You have a reception, you've got rooms, but there's no food and beverage. And then full service hotels are the ones that offer the gamut of having a restaurant, having a bar, having room service, a mini bar inside the room. So it's a full service hotel. Even within the full service hotel, of course, you also have different levels or layers. You've got lifestyle hotels, you've got luxury hotels, and I've worked in both of those areas, right? So a lifestyle hotel typically doesn't have all of the amenities that a luxury hotel would have. I'll give you an example. Sometimes turn down in a lifestyle hotel may be upon request, so you don't get automatic turn down, right? But where they do add a lot of value is in the programming. So they've got a lot of exciting programming happening all the time, collaborations with exciting brands, really turning every space that you have in the hotel into something exciting and fun, whether it's an artwork or painting a mural or having live music. So it's really about the programming, and that's what turns it into a lifestyle brand. And then the luxury, more traditional luxury brands, like the ones I've worked in, Four Seasons and Taj Hotels and Six Senses, all have this full range of offerings in addition to the programming piece. And they abide by a higher level of standards, which are typically the Forbes travel guide standards that do differentiate you between a 4-star or a 5-star. And in fact, it's a big deal when a hotel receives the 5 stars, because it means that they've gone through a very rigorous process of testing of standards, where they have to achieve a 90 or above in the first audit, which is a mystery shopping audit. And then if they achieve the 90% or above, then they come a second time to verify that they are actually performing at that level. And these are audits that are performed without any previous notice. And yeah, so these are the distinctions, I would say, between the different hotels.
David, for the sake of today's conversation, we're really focused in on the most senior role in the most luxury of hotel experiences in the world, right? And I'd like you to remind everybody that as a hotel general manager, you have a series of progressions you're going to get to that role. Now, some might take different routes, but if someone has their heart set on, I really want to work for the W brand or the Four Seasons or the Ritz-Carlton or the Peninsula or whatever the next brand might be, What are there some natural rungs on the ladder to say, here are the 8 or 10 steps you're usually going to have to master to get that senior appointment at one of the top, say, 500 hotels in the world?
Certainly. Yeah, it depends on which route you want to take going into the hotel. I personally recommend going in through a front desk agent role, but it all depends on the type of person too, right? So if you've got somebody that's very passionate about food and beverage, then that's the natural route in, right? So you would be a server, then you would probably be a captain, then you would probably be a supervisor, an assistant manager, a restaurant manager, and then you would move into more of a division role. So either assistant director of food and beverage, director of food and beverage, and then you would move into a hotel manager, director of operations type of role before going to GM.
Stop there for a second. So someone could literally, if you look at some of the biggest brands in the world, someone could start as a server and move up to a banquets captain, become a food and beverage director, and then they actually could end up becoming the general manager of the hotel through the food route.
Absolutely. It happens all the time. If you think about where do the guests of a hotel spend the majority of their time? It's in the food and beverage outlets, right? So the food and beverage outlets are actually the area of the hotel that get the most attention. And typically when you have a really exceptional director of food and beverage that can balance the creativity, but also the financial rigor and acumen that you require, they're very successful in the role as GM.
Thank you. Other routes to become general manager?
Yeah. So then there's the other typical route, because now it's starting to change and evolve a little bit. But the other typical route back in the day was the rooms route. So rooms meaning front desk, housekeeping, sometimes there's a link to engineering, spa. So all the other areas of the hotel that aren't necessarily food and beverage. And similar idea, you would start at a line level role as a front desk agent. Then the typical progression in these type of hotels is that you would move into this really unique position called a rooms controller that actually is the back end of the front desk that handles all of the inventory for the hotel. And then from that point, you move into supervisor, assistant manager. Typically, when you're in the rooms route, you will do a stint in front desk and in housekeeping before you become a director of rooms, because that position really encompasses the entire division. And then from there, again, hotel manager or director of operations and into the GM role. But now you're starting to see many more, which wasn't common before, but many more directors of sales and marketing, directors of finance, even directors of engineering that are making their way into the operation at some point in their career and then jumping up into this executive role.
David, I had the fortunate opportunity to interview a barber for this series. This series isn't just about white collar jobs or highly educated jobs, but every gambit. And when I asked this barber, what was the number one skill required to be a successful barber? And by the way, lots of barbers make six figures, not cosmetologists, but barbers make $100,000 a year. And her answer, without skipping a beat, the number one skill wasn't about creativity or stamina. She said, oh, it's communication. It's self-awareness. It's being able to communicate with 9 different leaders a day and knowing how to be in their space or how to give them some space or how to regulate how much you're talking based on their EQ and their own, you know, personalities. As you think about a similar question, what's the number one competency of someone who wants to be a hotel general manager?
I would say it's the same. It's people management. It's being able to empathize with people. So perhaps empathy would be a little bit more specific. Putting yourself in other people's shoes. Remember that as is particularly in the role of a hotel general manager, your job description says that you are the one that needs to keep all parties happy, right? And the parties that you're keeping happy, all the stakeholders are very different and have many times have very different priorities. So you've got the ownership group of the asset. So if we backtrack just a tiny bit, a company like Four Seasons, for example, has an asset light portfolio where they don't necessarily own the hotels, but they enter into management contracts, management agreements with different ownership groups that own the assets. And that happens for all of these brands. And so you are managing the relationship with the ownership group. You're managing the relationship with the corporate office of the brand that you're actually working for. In this case, a Four Seasons, a Six Senses, for example. You're managing your team underneath you. And many other times you're even managing an asset manager that's been appointed on behalf of the ownership group. And so there are so many different people that you're leading. And then you have to be a member of the community and an ambassador for the brand and for the company. Then you have to also manage the families of the people that you're working with and the different vendors. And so it's all about people management. One of the best pieces of advice I got very early in my career that rings very true is that in hospitality, every person is a job in itself. Every person needs to be treated like a job in itself. So you say I had 10 jobs, in my eyes, I had thousands of jobs because every single person I treated as a job in itself.
David, does a hotel general manager need to have some level of proficiency in the check-in process, the night audit process, how to make the bed, how to fix a TV remote, how to scramble eggs? At some point, you can't do everybody's job, nor should you. Your job as a leader is to achieve results with and through other people. At the hotels that you worked in, how important was it for you to at least understand, if not function in someone's job, not because you were going to do it, but because you had to understand what kind of skills that person needed to perform that job? How granular do you get in your understanding of each of the jobs in that hotel?
So I think it's absolutely critical to understand what the people go through. And there's no better way than to actually get involved with them. There were areas that I was much more comfortable in than others because I'd done it throughout my career. So for example, for me, making a bed was very easy because I learned early on. And so what I would suggest to people that are getting into these roles is to say, okay, the things that you're very good at, that use those as a platform to engage with your team and lead by example. And the ones that you're not necessarily good at, use those as the platform to demonstrate vulnerability and act foolish and look foolish in front of your team, because it teaches them that you're a human as well and that you're not perfect at everything. And I always use those opportunities, but I never shied away from jumping in and helping. And then another example, I remember when I was in the kitchen as an apprentice and I was cooking and I was cleaning, and the GM would walk in, and there were two types of GMs. You had the GM that would walk in and the whole kitchen would just stop and everybody would be worried and nervous and anxious and plates would drop and everybody. And then you had the GM that would walk by and they knew how to subtly walk by a kitchen and nothing skipped a beat. Right. And so that's where I say strive to be that GM, because when you walk by and everybody's in a very busy operation, what you want to give these people is safety and comfort, not the opposite. And so sometimes that means just stepping away, not getting in between. So you learn. But if you're in an area where you feel very comfortable, go for it and lead by example.
David, you opened our interview and you mentioned that one of the hotels you worked for was owned by a REIT, a real estate investment trust. And you alluded to recently, just a few minutes ago, that in some hotels, the brand doesn't own the hotel. You actually, the Ritz-Carlton, for example, will go find a group of investors, or they'll approach and they'll buy a particular property. And those owners, perhaps it's a sovereign wealth fund from a country, or it's a high net worth individual or a billionaire or a collection of investors getting together, and they put their money and they own the hotel, but then they contract with one of these brands to manage it for them. So for example, the Four Seasons, Ritz-Carlton, they may own some of their hotels, but they also may be just managing hotels they don't own. As the manager of one of those hotels, are you working for the owners, meaning like the people who actually own the building? Are you working, I'm guessing the answer is yes. Are you working for the hospitality company whose brand you're with? And I'm guessing you have sometimes competing needs to deliver profitability to the owners, but also guest experience and brand equity to the management company. To the extent I have that right or wrong, unpack that and explain to people what that tension can look like, especially when you're dealing with properties that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, you've got it right, Scott. So the management agreements essentially put the hotel company under contract for 30, 40 years, so long-term contracts. And most of the time, these contracts are based on a ton of trust and due diligence, and so they work very well and they deliver results. Once in a while, you'll see when the two parties really don't see eye to eye after the venture has started. But a lot of that pressure and a lot of that discussion comes down to the general manager role, because you're technically employed by the owner in most cases. There are certain companies that do separate the particularly the GM position and employ the GMs as the management company so that they don't run into this issue. But in all the instances that I've been a general manager, it's been working technically for the owner, but letting the owner know from day one that the jersey that I wear is the Four Seasons jersey or the Six Senses jersey or the Auberge jersey, because I'm there to represent that company and that brand and that image, because that's what we're selling to guests. It definitely is a give and take. And there are times when I have to be tougher on an owner, but also times when I have to be very tough on the brand as well. And now, especially, owners are getting more and more savvy. They're becoming more involved in operations. They're not just letting these hotel management companies just do what they want. So they're pushing the brands to think differently, to be differently. They don't want a cookie cutter approach. And so for some of these companies that have copy pasted a model and made it successful all over the world, it's not working anymore. And so they're having to rethink. And a lot of that goes down to the conversations that you have as the GM.
David, I met you through LinkedIn, about 5 years ago. You are one of the most influential hospitality voices on LinkedIn. You keynote, you write, you blog, you post. You're the LinkedIn of the hospitality industry in terms of all the connections you make. And through that, I had a chance once to visit you at one of your properties that was getting ready to open in Mexico. And I left with a better understanding of how much your time is split, I'd argue, between kind of three areas. I'm sure it's more than that. One was the people side of the business, right? Was the creating a culture where you were a unique employer in that community where talent can be a commodity, right? And can be a high market as well, too. So one, I saw you as people leader, culture creator. Second, I saw you as profit driver. At the end of the day, as the hotel general manager, your job isn't just to make sure everybody is happy at the pool. Your job is to make sure that you're delivering profit in the way in which the leadership needs. And then lastly, I saw you as sort of curator and creator of guest experience, how you were curating the arrival experience at this hotel, every step, every inch, every moment. If they turn left, here's how they check in. Here's what they can do while their credit card is being run. And just, it was remarkable how much time is spent on curating the guest experience. I want you to think about the future of hospitality. I'm guessing there are more than those three pegs. Where do you see the differentiation coming in the role? Or do I have it generally right that it's guest experience, leadership of team, and delivering profitability? Maybe there is more. Unpack that however you'd like to.
Yeah, it's as if you and I had this discussion already, Scott, because you hit it nail on the head. It's people, product, profit. It's quite simple as that.
We
right?
did it. I was just watching how you were spending your time.
Yeah,
and
that's the model. I like to go people, product, profit. I think that's the way to go, because I think companies that have gone profit first have really made some steps that are hurting them now. So if you ask me about what the future looks like, I think it looks more like people and empowering people and giving people the space to be able to do product and profit as well. And that means spending more time educating and training than we do. We are a type of business that is very much lead by example and learn by failing. And because the people that join the business are typically in roles that are very day-to-day and that are very in the moment. You don't put a lot of emphasis into sitting down and mindfully training people. And so the learning curve shoots up when they get to the level of division head. So after they've done their main department and they've taken care of their main department, and then you're giving them all of a sudden five or six P&Ls to handle at the same time and how to synergize those P&Ls. And that's when a lot of leaders have a tough time, particularly on the financial piece. And so I like to push my leaders to learn the financial piece as early as possible, and even if they're not in leadership roles yet. So we talk about product and profit every single day, because it's how then you get to the experience that you're trying to create for guests.
David, I want to do a speed round because I want to get as many questions in as possible. When you think about the luxury hotel business, the role of general manager, what's the average tenure? How long does someone stay at a particular property? Maybe they're in the brand longer, but what's the average tenure that someone is at a property in New York or Las Vegas or Hong Kong or Paris or Buenos Aires? Is there an industry average before the brand moves them somewhere else?
Two to three years.
And so it's possible that if you had a 30-year career as a general manager, maybe it takes you 10 or 15 years to get there, you were actually on an accelerated track. Say you have 25 years, you're probably going to have somewhere between 10 to 12 substantial geographic moves in your career.
Correct.
And what's the downside of that? You're a father, you're a husband, you have kids in school and sports and friendships. How do you manage the impact, I'm guessing positive and negative, on your family from recognizing that we're only going to be somewhere between 2 and 3 years and we're going to do it 10, 15 times?
For a long time, it was exhilarating. Now it's exhausting. as my kids get older. And the other piece, somebody once said it to me beautifully, the first phase of my life was not to establish roots, but to plant seeds. And so that's what you do, right? You go all around, you assimilate into these different cultures, but you also plant your own seeds in these different cultures that then germinate and grow and create beautiful friendships that come back to you. So people that were close friends of ours, we've got a beautiful network all over the world, but we don't have heavy roots in any one place or deep roots in any one place. And that also is very challenging, especially for the kids.
Let's talk about the benefits. I'm guessing you're the most connected person in the city you're in because everybody wants to know the name of the hotel leader or the best brand in town. Do you typically live on site? Do you have a penthouse on the property? Do you live off site? What are the upsides and the perks maybe of the job that people would hope were true, but you can actually confirm this is not true and this is true?
Sure. All the kind of top end luxury hotels, you typically will be offered a housing or accommodation option, not always in the hotel. If you have the option to take the hotel option or not, I highly suggest you do not take the hotel
That's
option.
It's a 24-hour day job, right?
You get consumed. Yeah, it's already a 24-hour day job, right? Because the hotel's open all day long. But if you're there and present, you're the first phone call. Whereas you want to train your team to be able to handle situations without you. And by keeping that space, you actually are able to accomplish that. You definitely get housing. You typically, if you have an expat role, you'll get car and school education for your kids. And then another really beautiful perk of these companies is the comp nights. So you get complimentary nights at other hotels within the brand. And there's a very close connection between general managers of these brands. And particularly in Hawaii, for example, I think we visited the different Four Seasons maybe 12 or 15 times in a matter of a year. My kids got spoiled that now a regular hotel for them is awkward. And so they're asking where the shrimp and caviar are at.
As my father said to me, son, I don't worry about you because you have champagne tastes on a beer budget.
There you
go. Your two boys and girls and your daughter are thinking similarly.
Exactly.
Let's talk about compensation. And maybe take this a little broader than just like the high-end boutique. What are the packages in terms of compensation? Where do they range?
So depending on the location and depending on the size of the hotel, you can go from making $100,000 a year, maybe $90,000 a year for a hotel GM in a small hotel or a boutique hotel to if you're in New York City or Hong Kong or one of these great locations, you could be making $350 plus with a very nice bonus structure. And some hotel companies even offer equity. And so there's really substantial packages that you can take on.
David, when someone burns out and they've made it to like your level, right? And you made it early, as according to most standards, every standard. When someone burns out, why is it?
Because they haven't taken enough time to feed themselves and to take care of themselves. It's a job where you have to give all the time. You're turning off fires all the time. The higher you go, the less people that ask you how you are doing. So if you don't build a structure of self-care and you actually make it a routine and a discipline, and that involves exercising properly, proper nutrition, sleeping properly, finding ways to disconnect and literally disconnect from the hotel environment from time to time. Because if you don't do that, then you just get consumed by the everyday, which can really get exhausting for sure.
David, is it likely that anyone who's thinking they're going to become a hotel general manager of any sizable hotel, they need to now in 2024 have an undergraduate degree from one of the hospitality schools in the U.S.? Maybe you could even name a couple of those schools. How many are there? How hard is it to get into? And is it a prerequisite to have a leadership career in the brands that we all know and recognize?
Sure. It's not a prerequisite, but it definitely helps, in my opinion. At least it helped me. And I spend a lot of time as a lecturer for some of these other hotel schools. In the U.S., you've got some of the biggest ones are Cornell, of course, and UNLV has a really great program. So there's a few. And then in Europe, there's some really well-known hotel schools, including Glion and Les Roches and Lausanne, which are the most well-known ones. And then you've got a hotel school, The Hague in Holland as well, that's very well-known. What these schools offer you is, unlike going into some other industry like international business, for example, where 90% of it is theoretical, in these type of schools, you're actually simulating a hotel environment from very early on. And so the best programs have these layers of line level supervisor, assistant manager, and manager already incorporated into the program, which is really unique because year one as a freshman, you're a line level employee. And then year two as a sophomore, you are actually a supervisor and you're supervising the freshmen. And you're in kitchens and you're in training and guest rooms. And so you're really simulating what you would live in the hospitality, in the hotel world. And so I personally think it's a great added value that you bring when you've got the theory plus you've got the experience. And my case is the perfect example. I took jobs early on with my education, and my first job out of college was a leadership role. And so that can easily be done.
David, I'm guessing that when you are the GM of some of the finest properties in the world, you're dealing with a unique clientele, right? People that are less price sensitive. They're probably more demanding. They require discretion and confidentiality. There could be security threats. They have a high level of service. I'm guessing you spend some time on conflict resolution, on dealing with guests that perhaps maybe are not treating your guests, your employees as well. I don't mean to equate wealth with humanity, but I'm guessing you also have had some experience where you've had some employees that haven't served the customers, regardless of someone's net worth or their expectation. Service is service and respect is respect. I'm guessing you're pretty steeped in conflict resolution.
Yes, I am. It was actually one of my specialties as I was going up. And it was one of the reasons why I ended up taking on these bigger roles, is because I was never afraid of it. I was never afraid of going and talking to somebody that was yelling or that was raising their voice. I had four older brothers. That happened to me all
day. So this actually happens. You could be in a beautiful lobby of a hotel with very sophisticated people and someone, a guest, is having a literal meltdown.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And they want to speak to the highest level authority, and there's nothing that will make them change their mind. And in these moments, I'll typically walk up to the people and just let them vent and let them go. And I don't take it personally whatsoever, because I know I just showed up and really tried to put myself in their shoes. And a lot of the time what people want to hear, if a mistake has been made, is simply say, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry that the mistake happened." That's the first thing, right? Because they're used to somebody saying, "I'm sorry, but," or "I'm sorry, this is what happened," and trying to explain themselves. And when you come in with a simple, "I'm sorry, that is terrible. I'm so sorry that happened to you," automatically they're taken off their kilter and say, "Okay, so now what do I say back to that? I can't be mean to that." And when there's that small pause and that moment of reflection is when you know you have actually diffused the situation. And then you can come in with alternatives and options, which is the second piece, right? And that's the other key breakthrough moment for me, was a lot of the time I would have one option for them, or even maybe two options for them. But what I didn't give them was the ability to be in control again. And so then when I realized, listen, I'm going to throw four options at them, two of the options are definitely not favorable for him or for me, but I'm going to throw them out anyway, because what happens is, I give that person their control back, right? And that's what they've lost. And that's why they get so frustrated, is because they've lost the sense of control, right? And they can't control it. And when you're talking to people that can buy their way into and out of almost everything, when they don't have control, they don't know how to handle that, right? You and I can handle that much more easily because we're out of control all the time in our daily lives. And so people that can buy themselves in and out of situations don't have that regulation established in many cases.
Thank you for that. That's giving me some leadership advice on serving my own customers. I want to land the interview with a final thought. Walk us through a day in the life of a hotel general manager. I know no 2 days are the same. I'm guessing if you have a property, you're probably walking it, although some properties are larger than others. Walk us through a typical day, or do you have a Mondays I do this and Tuesdays I do that? Or what does it look like as you're leading people, delivering profit, and creating experience for the guest?
Sure. The day of a hotel manager is tons of fun. Every day is different, of course. But in general, it involves walking the property, walking the entire property every single day. So I walk into all the bathrooms, walk into all the restaurants, walk into the spa, walk into the spa changing rooms, walk into the saunas, into every single space, every single day. And it was a practice that I held the entirety of my career.
Sorry, this is fascinating. That might take you an hour or 2 hours a day?
Yeah. It's usually when I first arrive in the morning, the first thing I do is I walk through and greet everyone, say hello, ask.
Do you bring someone with you and they take notes on, there's a chip on the door here, or this is?
No, I typically will take some pictures and then I'll touch base. And a lot of the time I'll wait, because we also have weekly or bi-weekly walkthroughs as well. So every week, the team, the engineer, the director of rooms, the director of front office have their walkthroughs that they spend. But as the GM, I like to make sure that I walk every space because you never know what's left from the night before. You never know if somebody missed something. So a walkthrough is paramount. The second piece is the morning meeting. So attending the morning meeting, if at all possible, is my moment in the day to regroup with the team of leaders, to share a little bit of inspiration, but just a touch pulse on
daily,
the operation.
Daily. So as a hotel GM, you might have what, 8 or 10 direct reports?
Around 8.
Mm-hmm. And do you do like a 15-minute stand-up meeting, a 30-minute meeting? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's typically 30 minutes. It's every single day. It happens in all the luxury hotels in the world. Most hotels have it in the morning and the afternoon.
I see.
Yeah, because they talk about what the morning operations like, the PM operations like, more focused on restaurants, bars, and all everything that's going to happen. But you talk about VIPs, you talk about movements, you talk about groups that are in-house, you talk about anything that has occurred. And then you review the glitches or the opportunities or the challenges that you had with guests on a daily basis during that stand-up as well. Very important piece of that.
When I think of a hotel and I think of the financial side, I think of revenue on the room side.
Yeah.
Is that also where the profit is? Where's the profit in hospitality?
Yeah, the majority of the profit sits in on the room side. It's interesting because now you're getting models of hotels with smaller room counts and bigger food and beverage operations that are now starting to get 50-50 in terms of the amount of revenue that comes into these hotels. Fountain Blue was a bit of an anomaly, but it was also because it had this nightclub operation and these big concerts and everything. The revenue in Fountain Blue was about 50-50, but you're talking about an 80-20 split between food and beverage.
I see. How bullish or bearish are you on the future of hospitality in terms of careers for people that may be making a pivot? They're coming out of college. They're thinking of making some change in their 20s or 30s. Or for that matter, maybe they've been in some other industry and they think, you know what? I love hotels. I want to travel. I want to go work in a hotel in Hungary or in Brazil. How bullish are you about the future of hospitality?
I'm incredibly bullish. I think it's a great moment to join hospitality. I think that it's going through a bit of a transformation. I think that the leaders that have left a legacy and have marked their stamp on the industry are starting now to retire and make room for a newer, younger generation of hoteliers that really want to push boundaries while still honoring all of those traditional elements of luxury and of hospitality. But I think it's a super exciting time. And there are so many great brands that are starting to emerge, more specific brands. And that's the one thing that I will say to these people that are looking to join the industry. Try to join the type of brand that matches your values and that matches your style, because there are so many different types of brands, right? For me, the double-breasted suit, the thick tie, It wasn't for me. And my career was a path of discovery to get me to where I really wanted to go, which was a brand that had really heavy values on sustainability, on well-being, a more casual approach to luxury, a bit of a more modern approach to luxury. But it took me a lot of trial and error to get there. So I would say, think about what your brand is and think about what those values are, because there is a hotel brand that matches that for sure.
Your bullishness is evidenced by the fact that it's about 5 a.m. in Spain where your family lives and you flew across the world to come to a series of U.S. meetings, I know, as part of your new role as a thought leader and creator and advisor and consultant to the hospitality industry. You're in Dallas today where it's now close to midnight. And so I appreciate you taking a shower and having a Coke and getting on our podcast today. David, you are pivoting. You may well go back as the GM of a hotel, but right now you're doing some interesting things in terms of your podcast, your writing and speaking. Talk a little bit about the adjacency that you have found in your own experience and passion.
Yeah, I'm incredibly happy to have found that hospitality is a communication vehicle. It's a love language, in my opinion. So I've broadened my idea of what I can accomplish with hospitality. Before, I was a hotel guy, but now I'm a passionate believer in hospitality as a love language, and I'm using that in different crossroads. So I have a new podcast that just came out. That's the Conscious Hospitality Podcast, where I'm interviewing some incredible thought leaders on how we can become more mindful and aware in the way that we behave both at home and at work, through the language of hospitality, of course, writing a few different books, one that I'm very excited about on hospitality specifically and honoring hospitality and the legacy that we can leave behind, but also another one on the future of teamwork and how we can better collaborate and co-create with people as we welcome the new generations into the workplace. And finally, just the opportunity to consult on projects with different brands that are at this verge of really making a breakthrough into what the next generation needs in terms of support, but aren't quite there yet. And so really excited about these projects that I'm helping different companies with.
If you haven't already, you need to be following or connecting to David Arai on LinkedIn, because I told you earlier, I think he's a sage of hospitality, not just in the hotel business, but helping other organizations build and curate their customer experience, their employee experience, and really infuse a level of hospitality in their own companies. David Arai, I'll let you go to bed. Thanks for joining us today on this episode.
Thank you, Scott. Such a pleasure.
Of Career on Course. Thank you, man. Have a great evening.
Thank you as well.
Thanks for listening to today's Career on Course podcast. I hope you are on fire. I hope you are inspired, focused, and ready for what is next for you. Perhaps you've had some clarity on a job you need to quit. Maybe you're enlightened about a career you never even knew existed, or you have key questions answered to make you focused on your next career journey. If you found the content of this podcast helpful, I'd suggest a next great step is to read the book that I've written called Career on Course, 10 Strategies to Take Your Career from Accidental to Intentional. It's available in hardcover, print, audio, and digital anywhere books are sold. We'd love to have you dig back into more episodes and refer any family, friends, or colleagues in case they want to get their career back on course.